firelight reflected off the water were rimed with drying sweat, and shifted, pale and ghostly, and blinked their red eyes. He looked at the captain. The captain was lying on his side, on the smooth rock incline of the basin, like something that had not quite made it to water. He limped around to the horses and got the rope, and sat with his knife, and cut hobbles from it for all the horses, and looped them about their forefeet. Then he levered all the shells out of the rifle, and put them in his pocket, and took one of the water bottles and went back to the fire. He fanned the fire, and he took the pistol out of his belt and pulled the cylinder pin, and put the loaded cylinder and the pin in his pocket along with the rifle shells. Then he took out his knife, and with the point of it unscrewed the screw from the grips, and put the grips and the screw into his other pocket. He fanned the coals in the heart of the fire with his hat, and with a stick he raked them into a pile, and then he bent and stuck the barrel of the pistol into the coals. The captain had sat up to look at him. "They will find you," he said, "in this place."
"We ain't staying in this place."
"I can't ride no more."
"You'll be surprised at what you can do."
He took off his shirt and soaked it in the Tinaja, and came back to the fire, and he fanned the fire again with his hat, and then he pulled off his boots and unbuckled his belt and let down his trousers. The rifle bullet had entered his thigh high up on the outside, and the exit wound was in a rotation at the rear such that by turning his leg he could see both wounds clearly. He took up the wet shirt and very carefully wiped away the blood until the wounds were clear and stark as two holes in a mask. The area around the wounds was discolored and looked blue in the firelight, and the skin around that was yellow. He leaned and ran a stick through the grip frames of the pistol and swung it up and away from the fire into his shadow and looked at it and then put it back. The captain was sitting holding his arm in his lap and watching him.
"It's fixing to get kindly noisy in here," he said. "Watch out you don't get run over by a horse."
The captain didn't answer. He watched him while he fanned the fire. When next he dragged the pistol from the coals, the end of the barrel glowed at a dull red heat. And he laid it on the rocks and picked it up quickly by the grips in the wet shirt and jammed the red-hot barrel, ash and all, down into the hole in his leg. The captain either did not know what he was going to do or, knowing, did not believe. He tried to rise to his feet and fell backwards and almost slid into the Tinaja. John Grady had begun to shout even before the gunmetal hissed in the meat. His shout clapped shut the calls of lesser creatures everywhere about them in the night, and the horses all stood swimming up into the darkness beyond the fire and squatting in terror on their great thighs, screaming and pawing the stars. And he drew breath, and howled again and jammed the gun barrel into the second wound and held it the longer in deference to the cooling of the metal, and then he fell over on his side and dropped the revolver on the rocks, where it clattered and turned and slid down the basin and vanished hissing into the pool. He'd seized the fleshy part of his thumb in his teeth, shaking in agony. With the other hand, he reached for the water bottle, standing unstoppered on the rocks, and poured water over his leg, and heard the flesh hiss like something on a spit. And he gasped and let the bottle fall, and he raised up and called out his horse's name to him softly, where he scrambled and fell on the rocks in his hobbles among the others, that he might ease the fright in the horse's heart. When he turned and reached for the water bottle, where it lay draining on the rocks, the captain kicked it away with his boot. He looked up. He was standing over him with the rifle. He held it with the stock under his armpit, and he gestured upward with it. "Get up," he said. He pushed himself up on the rocks and looked across the tank toward the horses. He could only see two of them, and he thought the third one must have run out down the arroyo, and he couldn't tell which one was missing, but guessed it was the Blevins horse. He got hold of his belt and managed to get his breeches back on.
"Where is the keys?" said the captain.
He pushed himself up and rose and turned and took the rifle away from the captain. The hammer dropped with a dull metallic snap.
"Get back over there and sit down," he said.
The captain hesitated.
The man's dark eyes were turned toward the fire, and he could see the calculation in them, and he was in such a rage of pain he thought he might have killed him had the gun been loaded. He grabbed the chain between the handcuffs and yanked the man past him, and the captain gave out a low cry and went tottering off, bent over and holding his arm. He got the shells out and sat and reloaded the rifle. He reloaded it one shell at a time, sweating and wheezing and trying to concentrate. He hadn't known how stupid pain could make you, and he thought it should be the other way around, or what was the good of it? When he'd got the rifle loaded, he picked up the wet rag of a shirt and used it to carry a brand from the fire down to the edge of the tank, where he stood holding it out over the water. The water was dead clear in the stone pool, and he could see the pistol. Then he waded out and bent and picked it up and stuck it in his belt. He walked out in the tank till the water was to his thigh, which was as deep as it got, and he stood there soaking the blood out of his trousers and the fire out of his wounds, and talking to his horse. The horse limped down to the edge of the water and stood, and he stood in the dark Tinaja with his rifle over his shoulder, holding the brand above him until it burned out. And then he stood holding the crooked orange ember of it, still talking to the horse. They left the fire burning in the tank and rode out down the draw and picked up the Blevins horse and pushed on. The night was overcast to the south, the way they'd come, and there was rain in the air. He rode Red Bow bareback in the fore of their little caravan, and he held up from time to time to listen, but there was nothing to hear. The fire in the tank behind them was invisible, save for the play of it on the rocks of the Rincon, and as they rode it receded to a faint glow, pocketed in the otherwise dark of the desert night, and then vanished altogether. They rode up out of the wash and went on along the south-facing slope of the ridge, the country dark and silent and without boundary, and the tall aloes passing blackly along the ridge one by one. He reckoned it to be some time past midnight. He looked back at the captain from time to time, but the captain rode slumped in the saddle on Rawlins' horse and seemed much reduced by his adventures. They rode on. He had knotted his wet rag of his shirt through his belt, and he rode naked to the waist, and he was very cold. And he told the horse that it was going to be a long night, and it was. Sometime in the night he fell asleep. The clatter of the rifle dropping on the rocky ground woke him, and he pulled up and turned and rode back. He sat, looking down at the rifle. The captain sat Rawlins' horse, watching him. He wasn't sure he could get back on the horse, and he thought about leaving the rifle there. In the end, he slid down and picked up the rifle and then led the horse up along Junior's offside and told the captain to shuck his foot out of the stirrup, and he used the stirrup to mount up onto his own horse, and they rode on again. Dawn found him sitting alone on the gravel face of the slope, with the rifle leaning against his shoulder and the water bottle at his feet, watching the shape of the desert country form itself out of the gray light. Mesa and plain, the dark shape of the mountains to the east, beyond which the sun was rising. He picked up the water bottle and twisted out the stopper and drank, and sat holding the bottle. Then he drank again. The first bars of sunlight broke past the rock buttes of the mountains to the east and fell 50 miles across the plain. Nothing moved. On the facing slope of the valley a mile away, 7 deer stood watching him. He sat for a long time. When he climbed back up the ridge to the cedars where he'd left the horses, the captain was sitting on the ground, and he looked badly used up. "Let's go," he said. The captain looked up. "I can go no farther," he said. "Let's go," he said. "Podemos descansar un poco más adelante. Vámonos." They rode down off the ridge and up a long, narrow valley looking for water, but there was no water. They climbed out and crossed into the valley to the east, and the sun was well up, and it felt good on his back, and he tied the shirt around his waist so it would dry. By the time they crested out above the valley, it was mid-morning, and the horses were in badly failing plight, and it occurred to him that the captain might die. The water they found was at a stone stock tank, and they dismounted and drank from the standpipe and watered the horses, and sat in the bands of shade from the dead and twisted oaks at the tank, and watched the open country below them. A few cattle stood, perhaps a mile away. They were looking to the east, not grazing. He turned to see what they were watching, but there was nothing there. He looked at the captain, a gray and shrunken figure. The heel was missing from one boot. There were streaks of black and streaks of ash on his trouser legs from the fire, and his buckled belt hung in a loop from his neck where he'd been using it to sling his arm. "I ain't going to kill you," he said. "I'm not like you." The captain didn't answer. He pulled himself up and took out the keys from his pocket, and using the rifle to steady himself, he hobbled over and bent and took hold of the captain's wrists and unmanacled them. The captain looked down at his wrists. They were discolored and raw from the cuffs, and he sat rubbing them gently. John Grady stood over him. "Take off your shirt," he said. "I'm going to pull that shoulder."
"Mande," said the captain. "Quítese su camisa."
The captain shook his head and held his arm against him like a child.
"Don't sull up on me. I ain't asking, I'm telling."
"Cómo?" "No tiene otra salida."
He got the captain's shirt off and spread it out and made him lie on his back. The shoulder was badly discolored, and his whole upper arm was a deep blue. He looked up. The beaded sweat glistened on his forehead. John Grady sat and put his booted foot in the captain's armpit and gripped the captain's arm by the wrist and upper elbow and rotated it slightly. The captain looked at him like a man falling from a cliff.
"Don't worry," he said. "My family's been practicing medicine on Mexicans 100 years.
If the captain had made up his mind not to cry out, he did not succeed. The horses started and milled and tried to hide behind one another. He reached up and grabbed his arm as if he'd reclaim it, but John Grady had felt the coupling pop into place, and he gripped the shoulder and rotated the arm again while the captain tossed his head and gasped. Then he let him go and picked up the rifle and rose.
"Está compuesto,"
wheezed the captain.
"Yeah, you're all set."
He held his arm and lay, blinking.
"Put on your shirt and let's go," said John Grady. "We ain't setting out here in the open till your friends show up."
Ascending into the low hills, they passed a small estancia, and they dismounted and went afoot through the ruins of a cornfield and found some melons and sat in the stony, washed-out furrows and ate them. He hobbled down the rows and gathered melons and carried them out through the field to where the horses stood and broke them open on the ground at their feet for them to feed on. And he stood leaning on the rifle and looked toward the house. Some turkeys stepped about in the yard, and there was a pole corral beyond the house in which stood several horses. He went back and got the captain, and they mounted up and rode on. When he looked back from the ridge above the estancia, he could see that it was more extensive. There was a cluster of buildings above the house, and he could see the quadrangles laid out by the fences and the adobe walls and irrigation ditches. A number of rangy and slat-ribbed cattle stood about in the scrub. He heard a rooster crow in the noon heat. He heard a steady, distant hammering of metal, as of someone at a forge. They plodded on at a poor pace, up through the hills. He'd unloaded the rifle to save carrying it, and it was tied along the saddle skirt of the captain's horse, and he had reassembled the fire-blackened revolver and loaded it and put it in his belt. He rode Blevins' horse, and the animal had an easy gait, and his leg had not stopped hurting, but it was the only thing keeping him awake. In the early evening, from the eastern rim of the mesa, he sat and studied the country while the horses rested. A hawk and a hawk's shadow that skated like a paper bird crossed the slopes below. He studied the terrain beyond, and after a while he saw riders riding. They were perhaps 5 miles away. He watched them, and they dropped from sight into a cut or into a shadow. Then they appeared again. He mounted up, and they rode on. The captain slept, tottering in the saddle with his arms slung through his belt. It was cool in the higher country, and when the sun set it was going to be cold.
He pushed on, and before dark they found a deep ravine in the north slope of the ridge they'd crossed, and they descended and found standing water among the rocks, and the horses clambered and scrabbled their way down and stood drinking. He unsaddled Junior and cuffed the captain's bracelets through the wooden stirrups, and told him he was free to go as far as he thought he could carry the saddle. Then he built a fire in the rocks, and kicked out a place in the ground for his hip, and lay down and stretched out his aching leg, and put the pistol in his belt and closed his eyes. In his sleep, he could hear the horses stepping among the rocks, and he could hear them drink from the shallow pools in the dark, where the rocks lay smooth and rectilinear as the stones of ancient ruins, and the water from their muzzles dripped and rang like water dripping in a well. And in his sleep, he dreamt of horses. And the horses in his dream moved gravely among the tilted stones like horses come upon an antique site where some ordering of the world had failed. And if anything had been written on the stones, the weathers had taken it away again, and the horses were wary, and moved with great circumspection, carrying in their blood as they did the recollection of this and other places, where horses once had been, and would be again. Finally, what he saw in his dream was that the order in the horse's heart was more durable, for it was written in a place where no rain could erase it. When he woke, there were three men standing over him. They wore serapes over their shoulders, and one of them was holding the empty rifle, and all of them wore pistols. The fire was burning from brush they'd piled on it, but he was very cold, and he had no way to know how long he'd been sleeping. He sat up. The man with the rifle snapped his fingers and held out his hand.
"Deme las llaves," he said.
He reached into his pocket and took out the keys and handed them up. He and one of the other men walked over to where the captain sat, chained to the saddle at the far side of the fire. The third man stood by him. They freed the captain, and the one carrying the rifle came back.
"¿Cuáles de los caballos son suyos?" he said.
"Todos son míos."
The man studied his eyes in the firelight. He walked back to the others, and they talked. When they came past with the captain's hands were cuffed behind him. The man carrying the rifle levered the action open, and when he saw that the gun was empty, stood it against a rock. He looked at John Grady.
"¿Dónde está su serape?"
he said.
"No tengo."
The man loosed the blanket from his own shoulders and swung it in a slow Veronica and handed it to him. Then he turned, and they passed on out of the firelight to where their horses were standing in the dark with other companions, other horses.
"¿Quiénes son ustedes?"
he called. The man who'd given him his serape turned at the outer edge of the light and touched the brim of his hat.
"Hombres del país," he said.
Then all went on. "Men of the country." He sat listening as they rode up out of the ravine, and then they were gone. He never saw them again. In the morning he saddled Red Bow, and driving the other two horses before him, he rode up from the ravine and turned north along the mesa. He rode all day, and the day clouded before him, and a cool wind was coming down country. He'd reloaded the rifle, and he carried it across the bow of the saddle, then rode with the serape over his shoulders, and loose-herded the riderless horses before him. By evening all the north country was black, and the wind was cold, and he picked his way along the rim country through the sparse swales of grass and broken volcanic rock, and he sat above a highland bajada in the cold blue dusk with a rifle across his knee, while the staked horses grazed behind him, and at the last hour light enough by which to see the iron sights of the rifle, five deer entered the bajada and pricked their ears and stood and then bent to graze. He picked out the smallest doe among them and shot her. Blevin's horse rose howling where he'd tied it, and the deer in the bajada leapt away and vanished in the dusk, and the little doe lay kicking. When he reached her, she lay in her blood in the grass, and he knelt with the rifle and put his hand on her neck, and she looked at him, and her eyes were warm and wet, and there was no fear in them, and then she died. He sat watching her for a long time. He thought about the captain, and he wondered if he were alive, and he thought about Blevins. He thought about Alejandra, and he remembered her the first time he ever saw her passing along the Cienega Road in the evening, with the horse still wet from her riding it in the lake. And he remembered the birds and the cattle standing in the grass, and the horses on the mesa. The sky was dark, and a cold wind ran through the bajada, and in the dying light a cold blue cast had turned the doe's eyes to but one thing more of things she lay among in that darkening landscape. Grass and blood, blood and stone. Stone and the dark medallions that the first flat drops of rain caused upon them. He remembered Alejandra and the sadness he'd first seen in the slope of her shoulders, which he'd presumed to understand, and of which he knew nothing. And he felt a loneliness he'd not known since he was a child, and he felt wholly alien to the world, although he loved it still. He thought that in the beauty of the world were hid a secret. He thought the world's heart beat at some terrible cost, and that the world's pain and its beauty moved in a relationship of diverging equity, and that in this headlong deficit the blood of multitudes might ultimately be exacted for the vision of a single flower. In the morning the sky was clear, and it was very cold, and there was snow on the mountains to the north. When he woke, he realized that he knew his father was dead. He raked up the coals and blew the fire to life and roasted strips cut from the deer's haunch, and cowled in his blanket he sat eating and watching the country to the south out of which he'd ridden. They moved on. By noon the horses were in snow, and there was snow in the pass, and the horses trod and broke thin plates of ice in the trail where the snowmelt ran out over the wet black ground dark as ink, and they toiled up through the patches of snow glazing over in the sun, and rode through a dark corridor of fir trees and descended along the northern slope through pockets of sunlight, pockets of shadow, where the air smelled of rosin and wet stone and no bird sang. In the evening, descending, he saw lights in the distance, and he pushed on toward them and did not stop, and in the dead of night, in deep exhaustion, both he and the horses, they reached the town of Los Picos. A single mud street rutted from the recent rains, a squalid alameda, where there stood a rotting brushwood gazebo and a few old iron benches. The trees in the alameda had been freshly whitewashed, and the upper trunks were lost in the dark above the light of the few lamps yet burning, so that they looked like plaster stage trees, new from the mold. The horses stepped with great weariness among the dried rails of mud in the street, and dogs barked at them from behind the wooden gates and doors they passed. It was cold when he woke in the morning, and it was raining again. He'd bivouacked on the north side of the town, and he rose wet and cold and stinking, and saddled the horse and rode back into the town, driving the two horses before him. In the alameda a few small tin folding tables had been set out, and young girls were stringing paper ribbon overhead. They were wet from the rain, and they were laughing, and they were throwing the spools of crepe over the wires and catching them again, and the dye was coming off the paper so that their hands were red and green and blue. He tied the horses in front of the tienda he'd passed the night before, and went in and bought a sack of oats for the horses, and he borrowed a galvanized bucket with which to water them, and he stood in the alameda, leaning on the rifle and watching them drink. He thought he'd be an object of some curiosity, but the people he saw only nodded gravely to him and passed on. He carried the bucket back into the store and went down the street to where there was a small cafe, and he entered and sat at one of the three small wooden tables. The floor of the cafe was packed mud, newly swept, and he was the only customer. He stood the rifle against the wall and ordered huevos revueltos and a cup of chocolate, and he sat and waited for it to come, and then he ate very slowly. The food was rich to his taste, and the chocolate was made with canela, and he drank it and ordered another, and folded a tortilla and ate, and watched the horses standing in the square across the street, and watched the girls. They'd hung the gazebo with crepe, and it looked like a festooned brush pile. The proprietor showed him great courtesy and brought him fresh tortillas hot from the comal, and told him that there was to be a wedding, and that it would be a pity if it rained. He inquired where he might be from, and showed surprise he'd come so far. He stood at the window of the empty café and watched the activities in the square, and he said that it was good that God kept the truths of life from the young as they were starting out, or else they'd have no heart to start at all. By mid-morning the rain had stopped. Water dripped from the trees in the Alameda, and the crepe hung in soggy strings. He stood with the horses and watched the wedding party emerge from the church. The groom wore a dull black suit, too large for him, and he looked not uneasy but half-desperate, as if unused to clothes at all. The bride was embarrassed and clung to him, and they stood on the steps for their photograph to be taken, and in their antique formal wear posed there in front of the church they already had the look of old photos. In the sepia monochrome of a rainy day in that lost village, they'd grown old instantly. In the Alameda, an old woman in a black rebozo was going about tilting the metal tables and chairs to let the water run off. She and the others began to set out food from pails and baskets, and a group of three musicians in soiled silver suits stood by with their instruments. The groom took the bride's hand to help her negotiate the water standing in front of the church steps. In the water they were grave figures reflected against a gray sky. A small boy ran out and stamped in the puddle and sprayed a sheet of the muddy gray water over them and ran away with his companions. The bride clutched her husband. He scowled and looked after the boys, but there was nothing to be done. And she looked down at her dress, and she looked at him, and then she laughed. Then the husband laughed, and the others in the party also, and they crossed the road, laughing and looking from one to the other, and entered the Alameda among the tables, and the musicians began to play. With the last of his money he bought coffee and tortillas and some tinned fruit and beans. The tins had been on the shelves so long they'd tarnished and the labels faded. When he passed out along the road, the wedding party was seated at the tables eating, and the musicians had stopped playing and were squatting together drinking from tin cups. A man sitting alone on one of the benches, who seemed no part of the wedding, looked up at the sound of the slow hooves in the road and raised one hand to the pale rider passing with blanket and rifle, and he raised a hand back and then rode on. He rode out past the last low mud-built houses and took the road north, a mud track that wound up through the barren gravel hills and branched and broke and finally terminated in the tailings of an abandoned mine among the rusted shapes of pipe and pump stanchions and old jack timbers. He crossed on through the high country and in the evening descended the north slope and rode out onto the foreplain where the creosote, deep olive from the rains, stood in solemn colonies as it had stood a thousand years and more in that tenantless waste, older than any living thing that was. He rode on, the two horses following, riding doves up out of the pools of standing water and the sun descending out of the dark, discolored overcast to the west, where its redness ran down the narrow band of sky above the mountains like blood falling through water, and the desert fresh from the rain turning gold in the evening light, and then deepening to dark, a slow inkening over of the Bajada and the rising hills and the stark stone length of the Cordilleras darkening far to the south in Mexico. The floodplain he crossed was walled about with fallen trap rock, and in the twilight the little desert foxes had come out to sit along the walls, silent and regal as icons, watching the night come, and the doves called from the acacia, and then night fell dark as Egypt, and it was just the stillness and the silence and the sound of the horses breathing and the sound of their hooves clopping in the dark. He pointed his horse at the pole star and rode on, and they rode the round moon up out of the east, and coyotes yammered and answered back all across the plain to the south from which they'd come. He crossed the river just west of Langtree, Texas, in a softly falling rain. The wind in the north, the day cold. The cattle along the breaks of the river standing gray and still. He followed a cattle trail down into the willows and across to where the gray water lay braided over the gravels. He studied the cold gray rips in the current and dismounted and loosed the girth straps and undressed and stogged his boots and the legs of his trousers as he'd done before in that long ago. And he put his shirt and jacket and the pistol after and doubled the belt and the loops to draw shut the waist. Then he slung the trousers over his shoulder and mounted up naked with the rifle aloft, and driving the loose horses before him, he pushed Redbow into the river. He rode up onto Texas soil, pale and shivering, and he sat the horse briefly and looked out over the plain to the north, where cattle were already beginning to appear, slouching slowly out of that pale landscape and bawling softly at the horses. And he thought about his father, who was dead in that country. And he sat the horse naked in the falling rain and wept. When he rode into Langtree, it was early in the afternoon, and it was still raining. The first thing he saw was a pickup truck with the hood up and two men trying to start it. One of them raised up and looked at him. He must have appeared to them some apparition out of the vanished past, because he jostled the other with his elbow, and they both looked.
"Howdy," said John Grady. "I wonder if you all could tell me what day this is."
They looked at each other.
"It's Thursday," the first one said. "I mean the date."
The man looked at him. He looked at the horses standing behind him.
"The date?" he said.
"Yes, sir."
"It's Thanksgiving Day,"
the other man said. He looked at them. He looked out down the street.
"Is that cafe yonder open?"
"Yeah, it's open."
He lifted his hand off the pommel and was about to touch up the horse, and then he stopped.
"Don't neither of you all want to buy a rifle, do you?" he said.
They looked at each other.
"Earl might buy it off of you," the first man said. "He'll generally try and help a feller out."
"He the man that runs the cafe?"
"Yep."
He touched the brim of his hat. "Much obliged," he said. Then he put the horse forward and rode on down the street, trailing the loose horses behind him. They watched him go. Neither spoke, for there was nothing to say. The one holding the socket wrench put the wrench on the fender, and they both stood watching until he turned the corner at the cafe, and there was nothing more to see. He rode the border country for weeks, seeking the owner of the horse. In Ozona, just before Christmas, three men swore out papers, and the county constable impounded the animal. The hearing was held in the judge's chambers in the old stone courthouse, and the clerk read the charges and the names, and the judge turned and looked down at John Grady.
"Son," he said, "are you represented by counsel?"
"No, sir, I ain't," said John Grady. "I don't need a lawyer. I just need to tell you about this horse."
The judge nodded.
"All right," he said, "go ahead."
"Yes, sir."
"If you don't care, I'd like to tell it from the beginning, from the first time I ever seen the horse."
"Well, if you'd like to tell it, we'd like to hear it, so just go ahead."
It took him almost half an hour. When he was done, he asked if he could have a glass of water. No one spoke. The judge turned to the clerk.
"Emil, get the boy a glass of water."
He looked at his notepad, and he turned to John Grady.
"Son, I'm fixing to ask you three questions, and if you can answer them, the horse is yours."
"Yes, sir, I'll try."
"Well, you'll either know him or you won't. Trouble with a liar is he can't remember what he said."
"I ain't a liar."
"I know you ain't. This is just for the record. I don't believe anybody could make up the story you just now got done telling us."
He put his glasses back on, and he asked John Grady the number of hectares in the Nuestra Señora de la Purísima Concepción spread. Then he asked the name of the husband of the hacendado's cook. Lastly, he laid down his notes, and he asked John Grady if he had on clean shorts. A subdued laughter went around the courtroom, but the judge wasn't laughing, nor the bailiff.
Yes, sir, I do.
Well, there ain't no women present, so if you wouldn't find it to be too much of embarrassment, I'd like for you to show the court them bullet holes in your leg. If you don't want to, I'll ask you something else.
Yes, sir, said John Grady.
He unbuckled his belt and dropped his trousers to his knees and turned his right leg sideways to the judge.
That's fine, son, thank you. Get your water there.
He pulled up his trousers and buttoned them and buckled his belt and reached and got the glass of water from the table where the clerk had set it and drank.
"There were some nasty-looking holes," said the judge. "You didn't have no medical attention?"
"No, sir. There wasn't none to be had."
"I guess not. You were lucky not to have got gangrene."
"Yes, sir. I burnt them out pretty good."
"Burnt them out?"
"Yes, sir."
"What did you burn them out with?"
"A pistol barrel. Burned them out with a hot pistol barrel." There was absolute silence in the courtroom. The judge leaned back.
"The constable's instructed to return the property in question to Mr. Cole. Mr. Smith, you see that the boy gets his horse. Son, you're free to go, and the court thanks you for your testimony. I've sat on the bench in this county since it was a county, and in that time I've heard a lot of things that give me grave doubts about the human race, but this ain't one of them. The three plaintiffs in this case I'd like to see here in my chambers after dinner. That means 1 o'clock.
The lawyer for the plaintiffs stood up.
Your Honor, this is pretty clearly a case of mistook identity.
The judge closed his notebook and rose.
Yes, it is, he said. Bad mistook. This hearing is dismissed.
That night he knocked at the judge's door while there were still lights on downstairs in the house. A Mexican girl came to the door and asked him what he wanted, and he said he wanted to see the judge. He said it in Spanish, and she repeated it back to him in English with a certain coldness and told him to wait. The judge, when he appeared at the door, was still dressed, but he had on an old flannel bathrobe. If he was surprised to find the boy on his porch, he didn't show it. He pushed open the screen door.
"Come in, son," he said. "Come in."
"I didn't want to bother you."
"It's all right."
John Grady gripped his hat.
"I ain't coming out there," said the judge, "so if you want to see me, you better come on in."
"Yes, sir." He entered a long hallway. A balustered staircase rose on his right to the upper floor. The house smelled of cooking and furniture polish. The judge was wearing leather slippers, and he went silently down the carpeted hallway and entered an open door on the left. The room was filled with books, and there was a fire burning in the fireplace.
"We're in here," said the judge. "Dixie, this is John Cole."
A gray-haired woman rose as he entered and smiled at him. Then she turned to the judge.
"I'm going up, Charles," she said.
"All right, Mama."
He turned to John Grady.
"Sit down, son."
John Grady sat and put his hat in his lap. They sat.
"Well, go ahead," said the judge. "There ain't no time like the present."
"Yes, sir. I guess what I wanted to say first of all was that it kindly bothered me in the court what you said. It was like I was in the right about everything, and I don't feel that way."
"What way do you feel?"
He sat looking at his hat. He sat for a long time. Finally, he looked up.
"I don't feel justified," he said.
The judge nodded.
"You didn't misrepresent nothing to me about the horse, did you?"
"No, sir, it wasn't that."
"What was it?"
"Well, sir, the girl, I reckon."
"All right."
"I worked for that man, and I respected him, and he never had no complaints about the work I'd done for him, and he was awful good to me. And that man come up on the high range where I was working, and I believe he intended to kill me. And I was the one that brought it about, nobody but me."
"You didn't get the girl in a family way, did you?"
"No, sir. I was in love with her." The judge nodded gravely.
"Well," he said, "you could be in love with her and still knock her up."
"Yes, sir." The judge watched him.
"Son," he said, "you strike me as somebody that maybe tends to be a little hard on themselves. I think from what you told me, you done real well to get out of there with a whole hide. Maybe the best thing to do might be just to go on and put it behind you.
My daddy used to tell me not to chew on something that was eating you.
Yes, sir.
There's something else, ain't there?
Yes, sir.
What is it?
When I was in the penitentiary down there, I killed a boy. The judge sat back in his chair.
Well, he said,
I'm sorry to hear that. It keeps bothering me.
You must have had some provocation.
I did, but it don't help. He tried to kill me with a knife. I just happened to get the best of him.
Why does it bother you?
I don't know. I don't know nothing about him. I never even knew his name. He could have been a pretty good old boy. I don't know. I don't know that he's supposed to be dead.
He looked up. His eyes were wet in the firelight. The judge sat watching him.
You know he wasn't a pretty good old boy, don't you?
Yes, sir, I guess.
You wouldn't want to be a judge, would you?
Well, no, sir, I sure wouldn't.
I didn't either.
Sir?
I didn't want to be a judge. I was a young lawyer practicing in San Antonio, and I come back out here when my daddy was sick, and I went to work for the county prosecutor. Sure didn't want to be a judge. I think I felt a lot like you do. Still do.
What made you change your mind?
I don't know as it did change it. I just saw a lot of injustice in the court system, and I saw people my own age in positions of authority that I had grown up with and knew for a calcified fact they didn't have one damn lick of sense. I think I just didn't have any choice. Sent a boy from this county to the electric chair in Huntsville in 1932. I think about that. I don't think he was a pretty good old boy, but I think about it. Would I do it again? Yes, I would.
I almost done it again.
Done what? Killed somebody?
Yes, sir.
A Mexican captain?
Yes, sir. Or a captain, whatever he was. He was what they call a madrina, not even a real peace officer.
But you didn't?
No, sir, I didn't.
They sat. The fire had burned to coals. Outside, the wind was blowing, and he was going to have to go out in it pretty soon.
I hadn't made up my mind about it, though. I told myself that I had, but I hadn't. I don't know what would have happened if they hadn't have come and got him.
I expect he's dead anyways. He looked up from the fire at the judge.
I wasn't even mad at him, or I didn't feel like I was. That boy he shot, I didn't hardly even know him. I felt bad about it, but he wasn't nothing to me.
Why do you think you wanted to kill him?
I don't know.
Well, said the judge, I guess that's something between you and the good Lord, wouldn't you say?
Yes, sir. I didn't mean that I expected an answer. Maybe there ain't no answer. It just bothered me that you might think I was something special. I ain't.
Well, that ain't a bad way to be bothered.
He picked up his hat and held it in both hands. He looked like he was about to get up, but he didn't get up. The reason I wanted to kill him was because I stood there and let him walk that boy out in the trees and shoot him, and I never said nothing.
Would it have done any good?
No, sir. That don't make it right.
The judge leaned from his chair and took the poker standing on the hearth and jostled the coals and stood the poker back and folded his hands and looked at the boy.
What would you have done if I had found against you today?
I don't know.
No, that's a fair answer, I guess.
Or wasn't there a horse, it would have bothered me.
Yes, said the judge, I expect it would.
I need to find out who the horse belongs to. It's gotten to be like a millstone round my neck.
There's nothing wrong with you, son. I think you'll get it sorted out.
Yes, sir, I guess I will if I live. He stood. I thank you for your time and for inviting me into your home and all.
The judge stood up.
Will you come back and visit any time?
He said. Yes, sir, I appreciate it.
It was cold out, but the judge stood on the porch in his robe and slippers while he untied the horse and got the other two horses sorted out, and then mounted up. He turned the horse and looked at him, standing in the door light. And he raised his hand, and the judge raised a hand back. and he rode out down the street from pool to pool of lamplight until he had vanished in the dark. On the Sunday morning following, he was sitting in a cafe in Brackettville, Texas, drinking coffee. There was no one else in the cafe except the counterman, and he was sitting on the last stool at the end of the counter, smoking a cigarette and reading the paper. There was a radio playing behind the counter, and after a while a voice said that it was the Jimmy Blevins Gospel Hour. John Grady looked up. "Where's that radio station coming from?" he said. "That's Del Rio," said the counterman. He got to Del Rio about 4:30 in the afternoon, and by the time he found the Blevins house, it was getting on toward dark. The Reverend lived in a white frame house with a gravel drive, and John Grady dismounted at the mailbox and led the horses up the drive to the back of the house and knocked at the kitchen door. A small blonde woman looked out. She opened the door. "Yes," she said, "can I help you?"
"Yes, ma'am. Is the Reverend Blevins at home?"
"What did you want to see him about?"
"Well, I guess I wanted to see him about a horse."
"A horse?"
"Yes, ma'am."
She looked past him at the standing animals.
"Which one is it?"
she said.
"Oh, the bay, the biggest one."
"Well, he'll bless it, but he won't lay hands on."
"Ma'am?"
"He won't lay hands on, not on animals."
"Who's out there, darling?" called a man from the kitchen.
"A boy here with a horse," she called.
The Reverend walked out on the porch.
"My, my," he said, "look at them horses."
"I'm sorry to bother you, sir, but that ain't your horse, is it?"
"My horse? I never owned a horse in my life."
"Did you want him to bless the horse or not?" said the woman.
"Did you know a boy about 14 years old named Jimmy Blevins?"
"We had a mule one time when I was growing up. Big mule, mean rascal, too."
"A boy named Jimmy Blevins? You mean just plain Jimmy Blevins?"
"Yes, sir."
No, not that I recollect.
There's any number of Jimmy Blevinses out there in the world, but it's Jimmy Blevins Smith and Jimmy Blevins Jones. There ain't a week passes we don't get one or two letters telling us about a new Jimmy Blevins this or Jimmy Blevins that. Ain't that right, darling?"
"That's right, Reverend."
"We get them from overseas, you know. Jimmy Blevins Chang. That was one we had here recent. Little old yeller baby. They sent photos, you know, snapshots. What was your name?"
"Cole. John Grady Cole." The Reverend extended his hand, and they shook, the Reverend thoughtful.
"Cole," he said. "We may have had a Cole. Hate to say we hadn't. Have you had your supper?"
"No, sir."
"Darling, maybe Mr. Cole would like to take supper with us. You like chicken and dumplings, Mr. Cole?"
"Yes, sir, I do. I've been partial to them all my life."
"Well, you're fixing to get more partial, because my wife makes the best you ever ate."
They ate in the kitchen. She said, "We just eat in the kitchen now that there's just the two of us." He didn't ask who was missing. The Reverend waited for her to be seated, and then he bowed his head and blessed the food and the table and the people sitting at it. He went on at some length and blessed everything all the way up to the country, and then he blessed some other countries as well, and he spoke about war and famine and the missions and other problems in the world with particular reference to Russia and the Jews and cannibalism, and he asked it all in Christ's name, amen, and raised up and reached for the cornbread.
"People always want to know how I got started," he said. "Well, it was no mystery to me. Whenever I first heard a radio, I knew what it was for, and it wasn't no questions about it neither. My mother's brother built a crystal set. Bought it through the mail. It come in a box and you put it together. We lived in South Georgia and we'd heard about the radio, of course, but we never had actually seen one play with our own eyes. It's a world of difference. Well, I knew what it was for, because there couldn't be no more excuses, you see. A man might harden his heart to where he could no longer hear the word of God, but you turn the radio up real loud. Well, hardness of heart won't do it no more. He's got to be deaf as a post besides. There's a purpose for everything in this world, you see. Sometimes it might be hard to see what it is, but the radio, well, my, my, you can't make it no plainer than that. The radio was in my plans from the start. It's what brought me to the ministry." He loaded his plate as he talked, and then he stopped talking and ate. He was not a large man, but he ate two huge platefuls and then a large helping of peach cobbler, and he drank several large glasses of buttermilk. When he was done, he wiped his mouth and pushed back his chair. "Well," he said, "you all excuse me, I got to go to work. The Lord don't take no holidays." He rose and disappeared into the house.
The woman dished out for John Grady a second helping of the cobbler, and he thanked her, and she sat back down and watched him eat it.
"He was the first one to have you put your hands on the radio, you know," she said.
"Ma'am?"
"He started that, putting your hands on the radio. He'd pray over the radio and heal everybody that was sitting there with their hands on the radio."
"Yes, ma'am."
"For that, he'd have people send in things, and he'd pray over them, but there was a lot of problems connected with that. People expect a lot of a minister of God. He cured a lot of people, and of course everybody heard about it over the radio. And I don't like to say this, but it got bad. I thought it did."
He ate. She watched him.
"They sent dead people," she said.
"Ma'am?"
"They sent dead people. Crated them up and shipped them Railway Express. It got out of hand. You can't do nothing with a dead person. Only Jesus can do that."
"Yes, ma'am."
"Did you want some more buttermilk?"
"Yes, please, ma'am. This is awful good."
"Well, I'm glad you're enjoying it."
She poured his glass and sat again.
"He works so hard for his ministry. People have no idea. Did you know his voice reaches all over the world?"
"Is that right?"
"We've got letters from China. It's hard to imagine. Them little old people sitting around their radios over there listening to Jimmy."
"I wouldn't think they'd know what he was saying."
"Letters from France, letters from Spain, the whole world. His voice is like an instrument, you see. When he has the laying on of the hands, they could be in Timbuktu, they could be on the South Pole, it don't make no difference. His voice is there. There's not any place you can go, he ain't there, in the air. All the time you just turn on your radio. Of course, they tried to close the station down, but it's over in Mexico. That's why Dr. Brinkley come here, to find that radio station. Did you know that they can hear it on Mars?"
"No, ma'am."
"Well, they can. When I think about them up there, hearing the words of Jesus for the very first time, it just makes me want to cry. It does. And Jimmy Blevins done it. He was the one."
From inside the house there sounded a long, rattling snore. She smiled.
"Poor darling," she said. "He's just wore out. People have no idea."
He never found the owner of the horse. Along toward the end of February, he drifted north again, trailing the horses in the barred ditches along the edge of the blacktop roads, the big semis blowing them up against the fences. The first week of March, he was back in San Angelo, and he cut across the country so familiar to him, and reached the Rawlins pasture fence just a little past dark on the first warm night of the year, and no wind, and everything dead still and clear on the West Texas plains. He rode up to the barn and dismounted and walked up to the house. There was a light on in Rawlins' room, and he put two fingers to his teeth and whistled. Rawlins came to the window and looked out. In a few minutes he came from the kitchen and around the side of the house.
"Bud, is that you?"
"Yeah."
"Some buck," he said, "some buck."
He walked around to get him in the light, and he looked at him as if he were something rare. "I figured you might want your old horse back," said John Grady.
"I can't believe it. You got Junior with you?"
"He's standing down yonder at the barn."
"Some buck," said Rawlins. "I can't believe it, some buck."
They rode out on the prairie and sat on the ground and let the animals drift with the reins down. And he told Rawlins all that had happened. They sat very quietly. The dead moon hung in the west, and the long, flat shapes of the night clouds passed before it like a phantom fleet.
"Have you been to see your mama?" said Rawlins.
"No."
"You knew your daddy died?"
"Yeah, I guess I knew that."
"She tried to get word to you in Mexico?"
"Yeah."
"Luis's mother's real sick."
"Abuela?"
"Yeah."
"How are they making it?"
"I guess all right. I seen Arturo over in town. Thatcher Cole got him a job at the school, cleaning up and stuff like that."
"Is she going to make it?"
"I don't know. She's pretty old."
"Well."
"What are you going to do?"
"Head out."
"Where to?"
"I don't know."
"You could get out on the rigs. Pays awful good."
"Yeah, I know."
"You could stay here at the house."
"I think I want to move on."
"This is still good country."
"Yeah, I know it is. But it ain't my country." He rose and turned and looked off toward the north, where the lights of the city hung over the desert. Then he walked out and picked up the reins and mounted his horse and rode up and caught the Blevins horse by its halter.
"Catch your horse," he said, "or else he'll follow me."
Rawlins walked out and caught the horse and stood holding it.
"Where is your country?" he said.
"I don't know," said John Grady. "I don't know where it is. I don't know what happens to country." Rawlins didn't answer.
"I'll see you, old partner," said John Grady.
"All right. I'll see you." He stood holding his horse while the rider turned and rode out and dropped slowly down the skyline. He squatted on his heels so as to watch him a little longer, but after a while he was gone. The day of the burial out at Knickerbocker, it was cool and windy. He turned the horses into the pasture on the far side of the road, and he sat for a long time watching down the road to the north where the weather was building and the sky was gray. And after a while the funeral cortege appeared, an old Packard hearse with a varied assortment of dusty cars and trucks behind. They pulled up along the road in front of the little Mexican cemetery, and people got out into the road, and the pallbearers in their suits of faded black stood at the rear of the hearse, and they carried Abuela's casket up through the gate into the cemetery. He stood across the road holding his hat. No one looked at him. They carried her up into the cemetery, followed by a priest and a boy in a white gown ringing a bell, and they buried her, and they prayed, and they wept, and they wailed. And then they came back down out of the cemetery into the road, helping each other along and weeping, and got into the cars and turned one by one on the narrow blacktop and went back the way they'd come. The hearse had already gone. There was a pickup truck parked further down the road, and he put on his hat and sat there on the slope of the bar ditch. And in a little while two men came down the path out of the cemetery with shovels over their shoulders. And they walked down the road and put the shovels in the bed of the truck and got in and turned around and drove away. He stood and crossed the road and walked up into the cemetery, past the old stonework crypt and past the little headstones and their small remembrances, the sun-faded paper flowers, a china vase, a broken celluloid virgin. The names he knew or had known, Villarreal, Sosa, Reyes, Jesusita Holguin, Nacio, Fallecio, a china crane, a chipped milk glass vase, the rolling parklands beyond, wind in the cedars, Armendares, Ornelos, Teodosa Tarín, Salomera Quez, Epitacio Villarreal Cuellar. He stood hat in hand over the unmarked earth. This woman who had worked for his family 50 years. She had cared for his mother as a baby, and she had worked for his family long before his mother was born, and she had known and cared for the wild Grady boys who were his mother's uncles and who had all died so long ago. And he stood holding his hat, and he called her his abuela. And he said goodbye to her in Spanish, and then turned and put on his hat, and turned his wet face to the wind. And for a moment he held out his hands as if to steady himself, or as if to bless the ground there, or perhaps as if to slow the world that was rushing away, and seemed to care nothing for the old or the young or rich or poor or dark or pale or he or she. Nothing for their struggles, nothing for their names, nothing for the living or the dead. In 4 days' riding, he crossed the Pecos at Iran, Texas, and rode up out of the river breaks where the pump jacks in the Yates Field ranged against the skyline, rose and dipped like mechanical birds. Like great primitive birds welded up out of iron by hearsay, in a land perhaps where such birds once had been. At that time there were still Indians camped on the western plains, and late in the day he passed in his riding a scattered group of their wickiups propped upon that scoured and trembling waste. They were perhaps a quarter mile to the north, just huts,